Tehran reacts to the EU's new sanctions on a number of Iranian officials and entities, saying it will soon release a list of reciprocal sanctions. The German foreign minister echoes the EU foreign policy chief's remarks, saying there are no legal grounds to list Iran's IRGC as a terrorist entity. Also coming up, Beijing strongly denies US claims that China is planning to arm Russia in its war against Ukraine, accusing Washington of spreading false information. Our top story this hour: Iran has vowed to impose retaliatory sanctions against the EU after the bloc slapped fresh bans on Tehran over the recent riots in the country. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the countermeasures will be announced soon. The EU imposed asset freezes and visa bans on 32 individuals and two entities, including Iran's education and culture ministers. The UK has also blacklisted 8 individuals. Most of those targeted are lawmakers, judiciary officials, and prison authorities. Western powers have imposed several rounds of such sanctions on Iran in recent months, accusing the country of cracking down on protesters. Tehran has repeatedly dismissed the accusations, saying it has been lawfully dealing with rioters disrupting public security. Iran says the West is using human rights as a tool in its pressure campaign against the country. Journalist and political analyst Mohammed Ali Iraqi tells us why the West has been imposing sanctions on Iran.
Since it started from the 1979 until now, the US has tried to bring the Islamic Republic of Iran under its paws to try and get the fist over the Islamic Republic. And technically, we know that the Islamic Republic of Iran has always refused to bow down to the United States of America and its allies in the region. They have literally run out of sanctions. The United States of America have run out of sanctions. The fact that they've entered education, this shows the absolute desperation of Washington, D.C., the people in the White House or the Congress. It completely shows that. The fact that they've targeted culture. Now, we know the main war that the United States of America has with the Islamic Republic of Iran and their framework, their ideas, it's an ideological war. It's an ideological war because the United States of America has a problem with the ideology that the Islamic Republic has. And therefore, the ideology that Iran has, that is the biggest harm, the biggest threat to America and their friends. The ideology, the culture that the Islamic Republic of Iran implements, you can see this everywhere in the region. The cultural work that the Islamic Republic of Iran does, this makes the building, the structure of the United States of America wobble.
The German foreign minister says there are no legal grounds to list Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps as a terrorist organization. Annalena Baerbock's remarks echoed those by the European Union foreign policy chief last month. Josep Borrell had ruled out such a designation without a court ruling. The European Parliament called on the EU to list the IRGC as a terrorist entity following the country's response to recent riots. Iran has warned of retaliatory measures if the EU goes ahead with the blacklisting. Earlier on Monday, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian also blasted the EU for its double standards on human rights. And Iran has criticized the decision not to invite the country to the Munich Security Conference. It says this denied the opportunity to present alternative views to U.S. unilateralism. Earlier, we discussed this issue in our news review program.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. Iran's foreign ministry has slammed the organizers of the Munich Security Conference for their decision not to invite the country for this year's meeting.
The conference was held in the name of international security, yet key countries like Iran and Russia were not invited. This eliminated the chance for the presentation of alternative viewpoints on international order and security. They prevented the expression of viewpoints different from that of the U.S. government, which seeks unilateralism on the international stage.
Khamenei said the decision not to invite Iran and Russia was a grave mistake and dealt a big blow to the reputation of the conference. The spokesman said organizers made another mistake by giving a platform to some anti-Iran elements, including the son of the former Iranian dictator, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. Khamenei called them puppets of certain countries and described their invitation to the conference as a major act of meddling in Iran's affairs. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. John Bosnich, a journalist, activist, and political analyst out of Belgrade, and John Stepling, author and commentator out of Norway. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start it off in Belgrade. John, what do you make of this, that instead of countries being invited, for example, in dealing with Iran, then we have opposition groups or individuals that are invited to the security conference?
Well, obviously, it's not a security conference. It's a war conference. And by exhibiting their bias, they are making it absolutely clear what they're intending to do, and that is to wage a war of aggression against Iran, to go beyond their illegal sanctions, to try to do a regime change operation in Iran. It couldn't be more clear. The idea that the legal Iranian government could not even have a representative at the conference leaves no doubt whatsoever as to the aims of the organizers, the aims of the people behind the organizers, and the aims of all of the participants.
Well, your take, John, out of Norway, it just seems that they're becoming more and more blatant and obvious and not even trying to cover under a diplomatic umbrella of trying to solve issues or work together. I mean, your take on, it seems just so extreme now, the way that they're dealing with this issue, whether we're talking about the way they're treating Iran or Russia.
Well, but I think you're exactly right. The hypocrisy is extreme now. As John Bosnich said, the bias is naked and obvious to any rational person looking at this. What's interesting, though, additionally, is that the U.S. went to this conference, the Davos of Defense, as this conference is referred to, and Blinken confronted a Chinese diplomat about the Chinese balloon incident. You know, which itself is comical. I mean, how Blinken can keep a straight face talking about this Chinese weather balloon that blew off course. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of weather balloons every year launched by countries. The U.S. is just trying to foment more tension and conflict by pointing this out. This comes less than a week after Cy Hirsch publishes an article. Cy Hirsch, who has like three decades of being absolutely reliable and correct.
Right.
A Cy Hirsch article about the U.S. with help from the U.K., Norway, and Poland blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline. There's not a mention of this. Nobody breathes a word of it. The mainstream press doesn't touch it. So, I mean, you look at that the U.S. since, I suppose, 2001, but certainly since maybe, you know, 2010 or 11, has managed to or attempt at least a total control of message, of media message. And they tolerate no deviance from this message. They don't allow alternative voices of any sort on any topic. The conflict in Ukraine is a perfect example. At this conference, Kamala Harris is already accusing Russia of war crimes, targeting civilians, raping children, all kinds of lurid tales without a shred of evidence being provided. Meanwhile, Zelensky is still begging for more weapons, and the EU, Ursula von der Leyen, she with her Nazi pedigree, is encouraging EU countries to accelerate munitions production. This is, as John said, a war conference. It's nakedly a war conference. It's a massive advertisement for more war, nothing but that. It's just shocking and depressing, frankly.
On that note, I'd like to thank both of you being with me here on this news review, John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst out of Belgrade, and John Stepling, author and commentator out of Norway.
Turning to some tragic news, now a 16-year-old Palestinian child has succumbed to his wounds after he was shot by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Montasar Mohammed Al-Shawa was shot by Israeli forces during a raid on the northern city of Nablus earlier this month. He was taken to hospital without a heartbeat but was revived and kept in intensive care until he was pronounced dead on Monday. Israel has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians in recent months. The regime's forces regularly carry out deadly incursions in the West Bank under the pretext of detaining Palestinians. And so far this year in the region, Israeli troops have killed around 50 Palestinians, including more than a dozen children. Israel's parliament has voted to push ahead with the cabinet's judicial reforms despite mass public opposition. This is the first of three necessary votes to enact the reforms into law. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu hailed the vote, saying it was a great night and day. Prior to the vote, tens of thousands of Israelis once again rallied against the reforms. Protesters blocked roads in Tel Aviv and tried to prevent lawmakers from the Prime Minister's coalition from leaving for the Knesset in occupied Al-Quds. Police said 8 people were arrested. The reforms increased the cabinet's sway in choosing judges and reduced the Supreme Court's ability to strike down legislation. Critics say the legal changes will foster corruption and bring diplomatic isolation. The reforms are the flagship policy of Netanyahu's cabinet, an alliance of ultra-orthodox and extreme right-wing parties, which took office in late December. And the removal of an Israeli diplomat from a summit of the African Union has triggered controversy. The union says it suspended Israel's observer status at the bloc last year, so no Israeli should have attended in the first place.
We have not invited any Israeli to this assembly. We have noted that somebody entered the hall with a badge. We asked the individual to quickly leave the hall. This is a person who does not reside in Ethiopia, and we are conducting investigations to know how the individual got accredited. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen of the press, we have not invited any Israeli authorities. We are going to push this investigation to the fullest to know where the error was coming from.
Video circulating on social media shows security personnel confronting the Israeli diplomat. That's during the opening ceremony of the summit before the diplomat leaves the auditorium. Israel has claimed its envoy was an accredited observer and has slammed South Africa and Algeria for the expulsion of the envoy. the regime attained observer status at the bloc in 2021. South Africa and Algeria protested the move at the time. They said it runs counter to the bloc's statements in support of the Palestinians. Earlier, political analyst Zafar Bangash told us about Israeli efforts to, quote, penetrate Africa.
Well, you know, we need to keep in mind that Israel is a pariah state, and it needs to be, recognized. It wants recognition, so it has been blackmailing and bribing some of the African rulers, and I'm sure that there is something untoward and illegal going on between the chairman of the African Union and Israel, because he took that decision unilaterally. But for Israel, of course, you know, it wants to penetrate Africa. It wants to claim that it is being recognized by the rest of the world. And I'm glad that South Africa and Algeria took this principled stand, and they pushed for Israel's expulsion. And I also like to pay tribute to the efforts of civil society groups in South Africa, in particular Africa for Palestine and the Media Review Network, that had carried a vigorous campaign through the South African government to throw Israel out of that union and not grant them observer status.
Turning elsewhere now, China vehemently denies U.S. accusations that it's planning to send military aid to Russia for the war in Ukraine. China's foreign ministry spokesman countered that it's the Americans who are endlessly shipping weapons to the battlefield. Wang Wenbin also reiterated a call to support a Chinese proposal to find a political solution to the Ukraine crisis. Beijing says it will publish the proposal this week. The U.S. has warned that any move by Beijing to provide Moscow with lethal support would seriously damage bilateral relations. The EU has issued a similar warning. Meanwhile, the U.S. is sending Ukraine another package of military assistance valued at $460 million. A Pentagon statement said the package includes 4 air surveillance radars, Javelin anti-armor systems, and HIMARS ammunition. Kiev will also be provided with artillery and mortar rounds. The Pentagon said the assistance will meet Ukraine's security and defense needs. Washington's most recent package of military aid to Ukraine comes after President Joe Biden's unannounced visit to Kiev. Moscow has repeatedly warned the U.S. and its allies that arms deliveries to Kiev will only prolong the conflict with Ukraine. And on that note, we bring an end to World Bulletin for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Warning about the mental health crisis in the United States, the American Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, announced that increase in suicide among teenagers and young people aged between 15 and 24 has become a very important problem in the United States. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. CNN has covered this story and tells us more. Health authorities in the United States have published the results of a new survey which paints a dismal picture of the mental health status of American high school students, especially teenage girls. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC's Youth Risk Behavior Survey, was published on Monday, 13th of February, offering a map of the teenagers' mental health trajectory from 2011 through to 2021. The data showed how an alarming percentage of American high school students are grappling with sadness, violence, and trauma, coming up with the overall conclusion that their mental health status is taking a turn for the worse. The report said nearly 3 in 5 teenage American girls, or 57%, felt persistently sad or hopeless in 2021. Doubled the rate for boys, adding that the figure showed a nearly 60% increase since 2011 and the highest level reported over the past decade. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, added that nearly 1 in 3 teenage girls, or 30%, seriously considered attempting suicide during the decade-long period covered by the survey. Up nearly 60% from a decade ago, and more than twice the number of boys. The study went on to show that nearly 1 in 5 teenage girls, or 18%, experienced sexual violence in the past year, up 20% since 2017, when the CDC started keeping a record of the measure. The Center for Disease Control's chief medical officer, Deborah Hoory, told reporters, "These data show a distressing picture. America's teenage girls are engulfed in a growing wave of sadness, violence, and trauma." Deborah Hoory noted, "Over the past decade, teenagers, especially girls, have experienced dramatic increases in experiences of violence and poor mental health and suicide risk." Kathleen Ethier, director of the CDC's Division of Adolescent and School Health, said, "This data are clear. Our young people are in a crisis." Kathleen Ethier noted, "Young people are experiencing a level of distress that calls on us to act with urgency and compassion." CDC officials said many of the measures taken to improve youth mental health had been moving in the wrong direction, even before the COVID-19 pandemic began in early 2020. Kathleen Ethier said, "The social isolation from the pandemic certainly made things worse. Young people were separated from their peers and from their community and school's support." Asked what role social media may play on the worsening mental health of U.S. adolescents, Kathleen Ethier said, "Social media certainly contributes." NBC News has also covered this story and tells us more. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, reported recent sexual attacks and other traumatic experiences have led to an unprecedented level of hopelessness and suicidal thoughts among America's young women. Overall, more than 40% of boys and girls said that they felt so sad or hopeless within the past year that they were unable to do their regular activities, such as schoolwork or sports, for at least 2 weeks. When researchers looked at gender differences, girls were far more likely to report such feelings than boys. Kathleen Ethier, director of the CDC's Division of Adolescent and School Health, said, "It was so striking to us, the consistency with which girls were faring more poorly than boys." Julie Sorrell, a licensed psychologist and director of the Suicide Prevention and Exposure Lab at the University of Kentucky told NBC News majority of kids experience much more interpersonal stress from schools, from their friends, and from home, unfortunately. The CDC survey found that more than one in five such youth, or 22%, had attempted suicide within the past year. Stigma and violence towards teenagers largely contributed to their poor state of mental health. Indeed, a dramatic rise in violent behavior targeting girls in particular was a stark finding in the CDC report. One such assault received national attention recently when Adriana Koch, a 14-year-old teenager, was attacked as she walked down a high school hallway in New Jersey. Adriana Koch's father said video of the incident was posted online in an attempt to make fun of her. Koch died by suicide just days later. The CDC said sexual violence, too, has risen among girls, with one in five saying they've experienced it within the past year. 14% said they had been abused sexually. That's a jump from 11% of teenage girls who said they'd been sexually assaulted in 2019. Kathleen Ethier said at the briefing, "For every 10 teenage girls you know, at least one of them, and probably more, has been abused sexually." Hoori recounted Monday a time when, as an emergency room physician, she treated a college student who had been sexually assaulted. Deborah Hoori said she was embarrassed and thought she hadn't done enough to stop it. The survey also found that alcohol use continued to increase, with 39% of high school students saying they drank alcohol in prior 30 days in 2021, compared with 23% in 2011. 23% said they currently use marijuana, compared to 16% in 2011. About 14% said they had misused prescription opioids, up from 12% in 2019 and 17, the first year that opioid use was included in the report. The website of NBCChicago.com writes, "The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC survey, did not ask students about reasons for their feelings of sadness or thoughts of harming themselves. While anxiety and depression increased among teenagers during the pandemic, the trends, especially among girls, have been building for years. Signs of a problem can be subtle, especially because it's normal for teenagers to act moody or pull away from their families during adolescence." The CDC's chief medical officer, Deborah Hoori, suggested asking teenagers about any unusual changes in eating habits and sleeping habits. Julie Sorrell, a licensed psychologist and director of the Suicide Prevention and Exposure Lab at the University of Kentucky, who was not involved in the CDC's report, said, "It's critical to normalize conversations about mental health and give young people tools to handle crises before they happen." She calls the strategy universal safety planning, adding, "The idea is that everyone needs to be ready for their worst day." Deborah Hoori advised parents to be as involved as possible. "Know who their friends are. Know who those friends' parents are." The CDC report calls for more programs in schools to address the ongoing and growing mental health crisis. Anna King, president of the National Parent Teacher Association, said, "We suggest that our schools start by educating their staff and their families all what mental health is, what supports are available, and how they can access those services." She also called on U.S. Congress to target funding towards kids who have suffered from traumas.
Food for thought.
Salam, dear listeners. And how about reflecting upon a maxim bequeathed to us for our guidance by the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him. Seeking God's forgiveness along with the insistence on committing the sin from which you seek forgiveness are additional sins.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن دوری از قرآن
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, moderation in food and sleep. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of moderation in food and sleep in the Islamic lifestyle. Obviously, when we are the human beings, we need to feed this material body in order to have energy. And therefore, we consume food. Now, there are a couple of types of foods which are being described by the material world as junk food or the healthy food. Other than that, there are some specific rules which we need to follow if we want to have an Islamic lifestyle. On top of that, we need to have the proper time to sleep as well. We cannot sleep for more than a specific time because if we do so, we are wasting the time. Therefore, in the Islamic teachings, when we talk about the food first, it says that kulu washrabu wa la tusrifu. Islam permits you to eat and drink, but do not be extravagant. Do not waste the things. And that's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the verse has said that annahu la yuhibbul musrifin, that Allah does not likes or loves the extravagance. Therefore, it is necessary to eat what we need. And intellectually, we can think about this, that when every year we see that certain countries or every country, they throw away the waste, they throw away the food because it is more than the need, it shows us that we are not eating according to what is the need. And we consume or maybe we buy more than what is needed for the body. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of moderation in the food and sleep. We said that it is necessary to eat and consume food up to the need that we have. On the other hand, we have many narrations which says that when you sit on the table, on the dinner table or the food table, eat up to a level which leaves you at the end a bit hungry and not be full with the food. Because when we eat too much or we are full, or the stomach is full, we are unable to stand up, we are unable to move easily. Therefore, if we want to have a healthy life, it is necessary to eat to a level where at the end we feel a bit more of consuming food, but we do not consume that food so that our body can easily move. On the other hand, about the sleeping matter, it is necessary to sleep on time. It is said to divide your time in four timings. There is a time for the for worshiping, there is a time for the firm family, there is a time for work, and there must be a time to sleep. Therefore, we must not eat a lot so that when we sleep and we cannot wake up. And therefore, there are many things which are being narrated. For example, about the Prophet Musa alayhi salam, once he asked Satan that, what things do you like in me? And he said that in the night when you eat food, you eat and you fill your stomach, and I like that. And he said, why do you like that? He said, because in the morning when you have to wake up for worshiping, you do not wake up on time, or maybe you become lazy, and I like that. And from there onwards, the Prophet Musa alayhi salam had promised himself that I will not eat food in the night in a way that I am full. Therefore, it is necessary to have the moderate way to control our food and to control our timings for waking, working, and sleeping, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Democracy in History. Part 2.
Perhaps it was because of Solon's reforms that Plato put poets behind the walls in his utopia or ideal city. Perhaps it was because he believed that it was poets who sentenced Socrates, his master, to death.
با چیزی که نیروها و قوای نفس میخوان با هم متفاوته. ما باید جانب عقل.
We should listen to our reason. Plato's utopia was based upon that rule, not what poets wanted or poetic thinking wished for.
درست شده. نه بر مبنای اون چیزی که شاعران میخواستند یا مورد نظر شاعران بود و تفکر شاعرانه میپسندید.
In the Apology, Plato compares Socrates to a gadfly that disturbs the lazy horse of Athens politics. But the reason Plato saw Athens as a lazy horse can be found in the contradictory relationship between Athens and Sparta. In ancient Greece, two Greek governments of Athens and Sparta were constantly at war, both with their swords and their beliefs. Just like the good and bad guys of old stories, they were always at loggerheads, from the method of governance to their treatment of people. The Spartans were soldiers. Sparta had a great military regime that had a government to rule over people. Boys who underwent military training under the care of the government at the age of 6 received a soldier's rations till the age of 30, and then had to eat at garrisons till the age of 60. A Spartan man would be exempted from the life of a soldier at the age of 60.
A true Spartan citizen was a military man till the age of 30. There were no exceptions. All their trainings were of the military kind, and they were not allowed to marry before 30. During that time, he was always ready to serve the government. He had to be ready to serve his city every minute of the day. And once that time was over, he had to get married. It was a governmental, aggressive, and power-hungry system.
Women fought, men fought, children underwent military training at an early age. Many of them died during the training because it was very tough and grueling. What you have heard about them leaving disabled children to die is probably because of this. They only wanted children who could fight.
This military state was governed by two kings, a king for war and a king for peace. One ran people's daily affairs and the other planned war strategies. But the structure of the government was based on consultation. The two Spartan kings were part of a council of elders known as the Gerousia, which consisted of 28 aristocrats over the age of 60. The votes of both kings held equal authority as others.
They had two kings who were in fact the leaders of their two main tribes. They had a council of elders called Gerousia. They were like a consulting board who decided whether to go to war or not. Those two were the military officials. We have the same in Rome, the Senate and the Emperor.
There was another council called the General Council of Appella, which accepted or rejected Gerousia's rulings without discussing their content. Something like the modern Senate. But all these councils were active at the time of peace. Whenever war started, the military was the main leader.
We don't know much about the Spartans' philosophical thinking to deduce what their thoughts and attitudes were rooted in. Aristotle and Plato always talked with respect about the Spartans and their government, saying that a strict system of order existed there, an order that it seems was undermined in the Athenian city-states.
Theoretical teachings in Sparta were sacrificed for practical and applied teachings. You may be able to compare it to some fascist regimes and even communist ones. You can compare it to them. Everything was governmental. There was no private sector.
The governments of Sparta and Athens were always at war because a bigger power was waiting for their weakening and fall at their doors. Iran. Iran was a vast country. It wasn't a city-state like Athens and Sparta. Iran's borders extended from the Indus to Egypt during the Achaemenid Empire. Establishing an integrated government of such a vast expanse to rule different clans and tribes looks impossible even today.
Every region had a different king who belonged to a similar ethnic orientation or political system. For example, they are Persian, and they all obeyed a king of kings. And this pattern is what defines the Iranian political structure by the late pre-Islamic period and a little afterwards during the Islamic period.
The Iranians had a federal government at the time. When Darius said, "I am Darius, the great king, king of kings, the king of countries," he was implicitly talking about a federal country. All these regions had their own governments and kings, but they all paid tribute to a central government in Anshan and Persia.
When Darius is talking about his subordinate regions in Behistun inscription, he says he has 23 dahyums, which can be translated into province or state. One of these states was Assyria, which used to be a kingdom state. Another one was Elam, which used to be a kingdom state. At that time, they all came together and united, and this united country had one ruler, who is called Kshatra Pavand, which can be translated as governor, better known by its Greek translation, satrap. Satrap is a governor who plays the role of a king, like in old kingdoms. For example, Cambyses, the satrap of Babylon, was the ruler of Babylon for a brief period, its king.
But this centralized structure did not allow the king's rulers in different parts of the country, who wielded a certain authority, being able to make decisions. It is true that they were like the king's eyes and ears, but they always acted in accordance with Darius' petition.
But becoming the ruler of such a vast kingdom was not an easy feat. The king had to be chosen by the gods and loved by his people. The combination of these two was called divine splendor.
This public participation in creating a government, civilization, and culture was rooted in the spiritual power that the ruler held.
And where did he get that spiritual power from? From the divine revelations that were granted to him by divine splendor and goodness.
The policy I'm talking about is based on a concept called Kiten. Kiten means something like splendor. It was assumed that among all those kings that ruled different parts of the country and were united, one was chosen by gods. One was stronger than the others and held a power called Ketin.
The concept of divine splendor was rooted in power. Anyone who became king had this splendor. Sitting on the throne entailed having this splendor, and anyone pulled down from his throne had lost his splendor. No one could become king without divine splendor. In Iran, when someone became king, he had the God's approval without a doubt, and people obeyed God's bidding. People bowed to the gods, not to any kings.
Those who deserved to rule were supposed to have certain features and experiences and be devoid of any suspicion of passion or worldly desires because of these divine teachings and secret revelations.
In other Achaemenid inscriptions, you can find direct references to key words that show this policy. Ahura Mazda is the god who created the earth, people, and happiness. A serious question is, why these three? That's what was said in the past, for example. Marduk is a great god that created the king of Babylon. Ashur is the great god that granted victory to Ashuri soldiers. Why earth? Why people? This is the first time people are mentioned. Why happiness? It's very odd. People's happiness.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Mitra,
an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I'm watching a movie with the theme of Iran's 8-year holy defense. Here I am at a movie theater which displays the movies participating at Fajr Film Festival. This movie is a narrative of Iranians' heroism during the 8-year imposed war on Iran. Well, I have made a sudden decision. Let me be more precise. In the world, there are museums which showcase war heritage. However, in our beautiful Iran, in the capital city of Tehran, we have a peace museum. Interesting, isn't it? So, why not be there? The idea of founding Tehran Peace Museum took shape following talks between the founders of the Tehran-based Society for Chemical Weapons Victims Support, SCWVS, and the Coordinator for International Network of Museums for Peace in 2005. The founders of Tehran's Peace Museum came to the conclusion that the sufferings of the Iranian people, which were caused by the enemy's chemical weapons, is a good reason for exhibiting the consequences of war and violence. Tehran Peace Museum was temporarily closed for public visitors in 2010 for redesign, and the new building, with a completely new design, was inaugurated in a ceremony in 2011, attended by guests from different countries, including the director of Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum. The Peace Museum of Tehran has several features, such as it is the member of the International Network of Peace Museums. Its active members, particularly the museum guides, are the victims of war and chemical weapons. Tehran Peace Museum is linked to other peace museums around the world. Tehran Peace Museum pursues the goal of promoting the culture of peace.